this little trick and then get the hell out of here. He dropped the letter into the mail slot. It fluttered down and landed on top of the other mail, two catalogs and a cable TV brochure. Just a business-length envelope with Polly's name and address centered below the metered mail stamp in the upper right corner and the return address in the upper left. San Francisco Department of Child Welfare, 666 Geary Street, San Francisco, California, 94112. "What is it?" Alan asked as he and Polly walked slowly down the hill toward Alan's station wagon. He had hoped to pass at least a word with Norris, but Norris had already gotten into his VW and taken off. Back to the lake for a little more fishing before the sun went down, probably. Polly looked up at him, still red-eyed and too pale, but smiling tentatively. "What is what?" "Your hands. What's made them all better? It's like magic." "Yes," she said, and held them out before her, splay-fingered, so they could both look at them. "It is, isn't it?" Her smile was a little more natural now. Her fingers were still twisted, still crooked, and the joints were still bunched, but the acute swelling which had been there Friday night was almost completely gone. "Come on, lady, give." "I'm not sure I want to tell you," she said. "I'm a little embarrassed, actually." They stopped and waved at Rosalie as she drove by in her old blue Toyota. "Come on," Alan said. "Fess up." "Well," she said, "I guess it was just a matter of finally meeting the right doctor." Slow color was rising in her cheeks. "Who's that?"
"Dr. Gaunt," she said with a nervous little laugh. "Dr. Leland Gaunt."
"Gaunt?" He looked at her in surprise. "What does he have to do with your hands?"
"Drive me down to his shop, and I'll tell you on the way."
5 minutes later, one of the nicest things about living in Castle Rock, Alan sometimes thought, was that almost everything was only 5 minutes away. He swung into one of the slant spaces in front of Needful Things. There was a sign in the window, one Alan had seen before. "Tuesdays and Thursdays by appointment only." It suddenly occurred to Alan, who hadn't thought about this aspect of the new store at all until now, that closed except by appointment was one fuck of a strange way to run a small-town business.
"Alan?" Polly asked hesitantly. "You look mad."
"I'm not mad," he said. "What in the world do I have to be mad about? The truth is, I don't know how I feel."
"I guess."
He uttered a short laugh, shook his head, and started again. "I guess I'm what Todd used to call gabraflasted. Quack remedies? It just doesn't seem like you, Paul." Her lips tightened at once, and there was a warning in her eyes when she turned to look at him. "Quack isn't the word I would have used. Quack is for ducks and prayer wheels from the ads in the back of Inside View. Quack is the wrong word to use if a thing works, Alan. Do you think I'm wrong?" He opened his mouth to say what he wasn't sure, but she went on before he could say anything. "Look at this." She held her hands out in the sunshine flooding through the windshield, then opened them and closed them effortlessly several times. "All right, poor choice of words. What I..."
"Yes, I'd say so. A very poor choice."
"I'm sorry." She turned all the way around to face him then, sitting where Annie had so often sat, sitting in what had once been the Pangborn family car. "Why haven't I traded this thing yet?" Alan wondered. "What am I, crazy?" Polly placed her hands gently over Alan's.
"Oh, this is starting to feel really uncomfortable. We never argue, and I'm not going to start now. I buried a good companion today. I'm not going to have a fight with my boyfriend as well."
A slow grin lit his face. "That what I am? Your boyfriend?"
"Well, you're my friend. Can I at least say that?"
He hugged her, a little astonished at how close they had come to having harsh words. And not because she felt worse, because she felt better.
"Honey, you can say anything you want. I love you a bunch. And we're not going to have a fight, no matter what."
He nodded solemnly. "No matter what."
"Because I love you too, Alan."
He kissed her cheek, then let her go. "Let me see this ash can thing he gave you."
"It's not an ash can. It's an Ozka. And he didn't give it to me. He loaned it to me on a trial basis. That's why I'm here, to buy it. I told you that. I just hope he doesn't want the moon and stars for it."
Alan looked at the sign in the display window and at the shade pulled down over the door. He thought, "I'm afraid that's just what he is going to want, darling."
He didn't like any of this. He had found it hard to take his eyes away from Polly's hands during the funeral service. He had watched her manipulate the catch on her purse effortlessly, dig into her bag for a Kleenex, then close the catch with the tips of her fingers instead of shuffling the bag awkwardly around so she could do it with her thumbs, which were usually a good deal less painful. He knew her hands were better, but this story about a magic charm, and that was what it came down to when you scraped the frosting off the cake, made him extremely nervous. It reeked of confidence game. Tuesdays and Thursdays by appointment only. No, except for a few fancy restaurants like Maurice. He hadn't seen a business that kept appointment only hours since he'd come to Maine. And you could walk right off the street and get a table at Maurice 9 times out of 10. Except in the summer, of course, when the tourists were spawning. By appointment only. Nevertheless, he had seen, out of the corner of his eye, as it were, people going in and out all week long. Not in droves, maybe, but it was clear that Mr. Gaunt's way of doing business hadn't hurt him any, odd or not. Sometimes his customers came in little groups, but far more often they seemed to be on their own, or so it seemed to Alan now, casting his mind back over the previous week. And wasn't that how con men worked? They split you off from the herd, got you on your own, made you comfortable, and then showed you how you could own the Lincoln Tunnel for this one-time-only low price. Alan! Her fist knocked lightly on his forehead. Alan, are you in there? He looked back at her with a smile. I'm here, Polly. She had worn a dark blue jumper with a matching blue stock tie to Nettie's funeral. While Alan was thinking, she had taken off the tie and dexterously unbuttoned the top two buttons of the white blouse underneath. "More," he said with a leer. "Cleavage. We want cleavage." "Stop," she said primly, but with a smile. "We're sitting in the middle of Main Street, and it's 2:30 in the afternoon. Besides, we've just come from a funeral, in case you forgot." He started. "Is it really that late?" "If 2:30's late, it's late." She tapped his wrist. "Do you ever look at the thing you've got strapped on there?" He looked at it now and saw it was closer to 2:40 than 2:30. Middle school broke at 3:00. If he was going to be there when Brian Rusk got out, he had to get moving right away. "Let me see your trinket," he said. She grasped the fine silver chain around her neck and pulled out the small silver object on the end of it. She cupped it in her palm, then closed her hand over it when he moved to touch it. I don't know if you're supposed to." She was smiling, but the move he'd made had clearly left her uncomfortable. "It might screw up the vibrations or something." "Oh, come on, Paul," he said, annoyed. "Look," she said, "let's get something straight, okay? Want to?" The anger was back in her voice. She was trying to control it, but it was there. "It's easy for you to make light of this. You're not the one with the oversized buttons on the telephone or the oversized Percodan prescription." "Hey, Polly, that's..." "No, never mind, hey, Polly." Bright spots of color had mounted in her cheeks. Part of her anger, she would think later, sprang from a very simple source. On Sunday, she had felt exactly as Alan felt now. Something had happened since then to change her mind, and dealing with that change was not easy. "This thing works. I know it's crazy, but it does work. On Sunday morning, when Nettie came over, I was in agony. I'd started thinking about how the real solution to all my problems might be a double amputation. The pain was so bad, Alan, that I turned that thought over with a feeling that was almost surprise, like, oh yeah, amputation. Why haven't I thought of that before? It's so obvious. Now, just 2 days later, all I've got is what Dr. Van Allen calls fugitive pain, and even that seems to be going away. I remember about a year ago I spent a week on a white rice diet because that was supposed to help. Is this so different?" The anger had gone out of her voice as she spoke, and now she was looking at him almost pleadingly. "I don't know, Polly. I really don't." She had opened her hand again, and now she held the Azka between her thumb and forefinger. Alan bent close to look at it, but made no move to touch it this time. It was a small silver object, not quite round. Tiny holes, not much bigger than the black dots which make up newsprint photographs, studded its lower half. It gleamed mellowly in the sunlight. And as Alan looked at it, a powerful, irrational feeling swept him. He didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. He resisted a brief, powerful urge to simply rip it off Polly's neck and throw it out the open window.
Yes, good idea, sport. You do that and you'll be picking your teeth out of your lap.
Sometimes it almost feels like something is moving around inside of it, Polly said, smiling. Like a Mexican jumping bean or something. Isn't that silly?
I don't know.
He watched her drop it back inside her blouse with a strong sense of misgiving. But once it was out of sight and her fingers, her undeniably limber fingers, had gone to work rebuttoning the top of her blouse, the feeling began to fade. What didn't was his growing suspicion that Mr. Leland Gaunt was conning the woman he loved. And if he was, she would not be the only one. Have you thought it could be something else? Now he was moving with the delicacy of a man using slick stepping stones to cross a swift-running stream. You've had remissions before, you know.
Of course I know, Polly said with edgy patience. They're my hands.
Polly, I'm just trying.
I knew you'd probably react just the way you are reacting, Alan. The fact is simple enough. I know what arthritic remission feels like, and brother, this isn't it. I've had times over the last 5 or 6 years when I felt pretty good, but I've never felt this good, even during the best of them. This is different. This is like...
She paused, thought, then made a small, frustrated gesture that was mostly hands and shoulders.
This is like being well again. I don't expect you to understand exactly what I mean, but I can't put it any better than that.
He nodded, frowning. He did understand what she was saying. And he also understood that she meant it. Perhaps the Azka had unlocked some dormant healing power in her own mind. Was that possible, even though the disease in question wasn't psychosomatic in origin? The Rosicrucians thought stuff like that happened all the time. So did the millions of people who had bought L. Ron Hubbard's book on Dianetics, for that matter. He himself didn't know. The only thing he could say for sure was that he had never seen a blind person think himself back to sight, or a wounded person stop his bleeding by an effort of concentration. What he did know was this. Something about the situation smelled wrong. Something about it smelled as high as dead fish that have spent 3 days in the hot sun.
Let's cut to the chase, Polly said. Trying not to be mad at you is wearing me out. Come inside with me. Talk to Mr. Gaunt yourself. It's time you met him anyway. Maybe he can explain better what the charm does and what it doesn't do.
He looked at his watch again. 3:14 now. For a brief moment, he thought of doing as she suggested and leaving Brian Rusk for later. But catching the boy as he came out of school, catching him while he was away from home, felt right. He would get better answers if he talked to him away from his mother, who would hang around them like a lioness protecting her cub, interrupting, perhaps even telling her son not to answer. Yes, that was the bottom line. If it turned out her son had something to hide, or if Mrs. Rusk even thought he did, Alan might find it difficult or impossible to get the information he needed. Here he had a potential con artist. In Brian Rusk, he might have the key that would unlock a double murder.
I can't, honey, he said. Maybe a little later today. I have to go over to the middle school and talk to someone, and I ought to do it right away.
Is it about Nettie?
It's about Wilma Jerzyk. But if my hunch is right, Nettie comes into it, yes. If I find anything out, I'll talk to you later. In the meantime, will you do something for me?
Alan, I'm buying it. They're not your hands.
No, I expect you to buy it. I want you to pay him by check, that's all. There's no reason why he shouldn't take one, if he's a reputable businessman, that is. You live in town, and you bank right across the street. But if something shakes out funny, you've got a few days to put a stop on payment.
I see, Polly said. Her voice was calm, but Alan realized with a sinking feeling that he had finally missed his footing on one of those slippery stepping stones and fallen headlong into the stream.
You think he's a crook, don't you, Alan? You think he's going to take the gullible little lady's money, fold his tent, and steal off into the night?
I don't know, Alan said evenly. What I do know is that he's only been doing business here in town for a week. So a check seems like a reasonable precaution to take. Yes, he was being reasonable. Polly recognized that. It was that very reasonableness, that stubborn rationality in the face of what seemed to her to be an authentic miracle cure, that was now driving her anger. She fought an urge to begin snapping her fingers in his face, shouting, "Do you see that, Alan? Are you blind?" as she did so. The fact that Alan was right, that Mr. Gaunt should have no problem at all with her check if he was on the up and up, only made her angrier. "Be careful," a voice whispered. "Be careful. Don't be hasty. Turn on brain before throwing mouth in gear. Remember that you'll love this man." But another voice answered, a colder voice, one she barely recognized as her own. "Do I? Do I really?" "All right," she said, tight-lipped, and slid across the seat and away from him. "Thank you for looking after my best interests, Alan. Sometimes I forget how badly I need someone to do that, you see. I'll be sure to write him a check." "Polly?" "No, Alan. No more talk now. I can't not be mad at you any longer today." She opened the door and got out in one lithe gesture. The jumper rode up, revealing a momentarily heart-stopping length of thigh. He started to get out on his own side, wanting to catch her, talk to her, smooth it over, make her see that he had only voiced his doubts because he cared about her. Then he looked at his watch again. It was 3:09. Even if he pushed it, he might miss Brian Rusk. "I'll talk to you tonight," he called out the window. "Fine," she said. "You do that, Alan." She went directly to the door beneath the canopy without turning around. Before he put the station wagon in reverse and backed out into the street, Alan heard the tinkle of a small silver bell. "Miss Chalmers," Mr. Gaunt cried cheerfully, and made a small check mark on the sheet beside the cash register. He was nearing the bottom of it now. Polly's was the last name but one. "Please, Polly," she said. "Excuse me." His smile widened. "Polly." She smiled back at him, but the smile was forced. Now that she was in here, she felt a keen sorrow at the angry way she and Alan had parted. Suddenly she found herself struggling just to keep from bursting into tears. "Miss Chalmers? Polly? Are you feeling unwell?" Mr. Gaunt came around the counter. "You look a trifle pale." His face was furrowed with genuine concern. This is the man Alan thinks is a crook, Polly thought. If he could only see him now. "It's the sun, I think," she said in a voice that was not quite even. "It's so warm outside." "But cool in here," he said soothingly. "Come, Polly, come and sit down." He led her, his hand near but not quite touching the small of her back, to one of the red velvet chairs. She sat upon it, knees together. "I happen to be looking out the window," he said, sitting in the chair next to hers and folding his long hands into his lap. "It looked to me as if you and the sheriff might be arguing." "It's nothing," she said, but then a single large tear overspilled the corner of her left eye and rolled down her cheek in silent contradiction. "On the contrary," he said, "it means a great deal." She looked up at him, surprised, and Mr. Gaunt's hazel eyes captured hers. Had they been hazel before? She couldn't remember, not for certain. All she knew was that as she looked into them, she felt all the day's misery, poor Nettie's funeral, then the stupid fight she'd had with Alan, begin to dissolve. It does?" "Polly," he said softly, "I think everything is going to turn out just fine. If you trust me." "Do you? Do you trust me?" "Yes," Polly said, although something inside, something far and faint, cried out a desperate warning. "I do. No matter what Alan says, I trust you with all my heart." "Well, that's fine," Mr. Gaunt said. He reached out and took one of Polly's hands. Her face wrinkled in disgust for a moment, and then relaxed into its former blank and dreaming expression. "That's just fine. And your friend the sheriff needn't have worried, you know. Your personal check is just as good as gold with me." Alan saw he was going to be late unless he turned on the flasher bubble and stuck it on the roof. He didn't want to do that. He didn't want Brian Rusk to see a police car. He wanted him to see a slightly down-at-the-heel station wagon, just like the kind his own dad probably drove. It was too late to make it to the school before it let out for the day, Alan parked at the intersection of Main and School Streets instead. This was the most logical way for Brian to come. He would just have to hope that logic would work somewhere along the line today. Alan got out, leaned against the station wagon's bumper, and felt in his pocket for a stick of chewing gum. He was unwrapping it when he heard the 3 o'clock bell at the middle school, dreamy and distant in the warm air. He decided to talk to Mr. Leland Gaunt of Akron, Ohio, as soon as he finished with Brian Rusk, appointment or no appointment, and just as abruptly changed his mind. He'd call the Attorney General's office in Augusta first, have them check Gaunt's name against the con file. If there was nothing there, they could send the name on to the Laws R&I computer in Washington. Laws, in Allen's opinion, was one of the few good things the Nixon administration had ever done. The first kids were coming down the street now, yelling, skipping, laughing. A sudden idea struck Alan, and he opened the driver's door of the station wagon. He reached across the seat, opened the glove compartment, and pawed through the stuff inside. Todd's joke can of nuts fell out onto the floor as he did so. Alan was about to give up when he found what he wanted. He took it, slammed the glove compartment shut, and backed out of the car. He was holding a small cardboard envelope with a sticker on it that said, "The Folding Flower Trick, Blackstone Magic Company, 19 Greer Street, Patterson, New Jersey." From this packet, Alan slipped an even smaller square, a thick block of multicolored tissue paper. He slipped it beneath his watch band. All magicians have a number of palming wells on their persons and about their clothes, and each has his own favorite well. Under the watch band was Alan's. With the famous folding flowers taken care of, Alan went back to watching for Brian Rusk. He saw a boy on a bike, cutting jazzily in and out through the clots of pint-sized pedestrians, and was alert at once. Then he saw it was one of the Hanlon twins, and allowed himself to relax again. "Slow down or I'll give you a ticket," Alan growled as the boy shot past. Jay Hanlon looked at him, startled, and almost ran into a tree. He pedaled on at a much more sedate speed. Alan watched him for a moment, amused, then turned back in the direction of the school and resumed his watch for Brian Rusk. Sally Ratcliffe climbed the stairs from her little speech therapy room to the first floor of the middle school 5 minutes after the 3 o'clock bell and walked down the main hall toward the office. The hall was clearing rapidly, as it always did on days when the weather was fair and warm. Outside, droves of kids were shouting their way across the lawn to where the number 2 and number 3 buses idled sleepily at the curb. Sally's low heels clicked and clacked. She was holding a manila envelope in one hand. The name on this envelope, Frank Jewett, was turned in against her gently rounded breast. She paused at room 6, one door down from the office, and looked in through the wire-reinforced glass. Inside, Mr. Jewett was talking to the half-dozen teachers who were involved in coaching fall and winter sports. Frank Jewett was a pudgy little man who always reminded Sally of Mr. Weatherby, the principal in the Archie comics. Like Mr. Weatherby's, his glasses were always sliding down on his nose. Sitting to his right was Alice Tanner, the school secretary. She appeared to be taking notes. Mr. Jewett glanced to his left, saw Sally looking in the window, and gave her one of his prissy little smiles. She raised one hand in a wave and made herself smile back. She could remember the days when smiling had come naturally to her. Next to praying, smiling had been the most natural thing in the world. Some of the other teachers looked over to see who their fearless leader was looking at. So did Alice Tanner. Alice waggled her fingers coyly at Sally, smiling with saccharine sweetness. "They know," Sally thought. "Every one of them knows that Lester and I are history. Irene was so sweet last night, so sympathetic, and so anxious to spill her guts. That little bitch." Sally waggled her fingers right back, feeling her own coy and totally bogus smile stretch her lips. "I hope you get hit by a dump truck on your way home, you hoary-looking thing," she thought, and then walked on, her sensible low heels clicking and clacking. When Mr. Gaunt had called her during her free period and told her it was time to finish paying for the wonderful splinter, Sally had reacted with enthusiasm and a sour kind of pleasure. She sensed that the little joke she had promised to play on Mr. Jewett was a mean one, and that was all right with her. She felt mean today. She put her hand on the office door, then paused. "What's the matter with you?" she wondered suddenly. "You have the splinter, the wonderful holy splinter with the wonderful holy vision caught inside it. Aren't things like that supposed to make a person feel better, calmer, more in touch with God the Father Almighty? You don't feel calmer and more in touch with anyone. You feel like someone filled your head up with barbed wire." "Yes, but that's not my fault or the splinter's fault," Sally muttered. "That's Lester's fault. Mr. Lester Big Prick Pratt." A short girl wearing glasses and heavy braces turned from the pep club poster she'd been studying and glanced curiously at Sally. "What are you looking at, Irvina?" Sally asked. Irvina blinked. "Nothing, Miss Ratcliffe." "Then go look at it someplace else," Sally snapped. "School is out, you know." Irvina hurried down the hall, throwing an occasional distrustful glance back over her shoulder. Sally opened the door to the office and went in. The envelope she carried had been right where Mr. Gaunt had told her it would be, behind the garbage cans outside the cafeteria doors. She had written Mr. Jewett's name on it herself. She took one more quick glance over her shoulder to make sure that little whore Alice Tanner wasn't coming in. Then she opened the door to the inner office, hurried across the room, and laid the manila envelope on Frank Jewett's desk. Now there was the other thing. She opened the top desk drawer and removed a pair of heavy scissors. She bent and yanked on the lower left-hand drawer. It was locked. Mr. Gaunt had told her that might be the case. Sally glanced into the outer office, saw it was still empty, the door to the hallway still shut. Good. Great. She jammed the tips of the scissors into the crack at the top of the locked drawer and levered them up, hard. Wood splintered, and Sally felt her nipples grow strangely, pleasantly hard. This was sort of fun. Scary, but fun. She reseated the scissors, the points went in further this time, and levered them up again. The lock snapped, and the drawer rolled open on its casters, revealing what was inside. Sally's mouth dropped open in shocked surprise. Then she began to giggle, breathy, stifled sounds that were really closer to screams than to laughter. "Oh, Mr. Jewett, what a naughty boy you are!" There was a stack of digest-sized magazines inside the drawer, and Naughty Boy was, in fact, the name of the one on top. The blurry picture on the cover showed a boy of about 9. He was wearing a 50s-style motorcycle cap and nothing else. Sally reached into the drawer and pulled out the magazines. There were a dozen of them, maybe more. Happy Kids, Nude Cuties, Blowing in the Wind, Bobby's Farm World. She looked into one and could barely believe what she was seeing. Where did things like this come from? They surely didn't sell them down at the drugstore, not even on the top rack Reverend Rose sometimes preached about in church, the one with the sign that said, "Only eyes 18 years and older, please." A voice she knew very well suddenly spoke up in her head. "Hurry, Sally. The meeting's almost over, and you don't want to be caught in here, do you?" And then there was another voice as well, a woman's voice, one Sally could almost put a name to. Hearing this second voice was like being on the telephone with someone, while someone else spoke in the background on the other end of the line. "More than fair," this second voice said. "It seems divine." Sally tuned the voice out and did what Mr. Gaunt had told her to do. She scattered the dirty magazines all over Mr. Jewett's office. Then she replaced the scissors and left the room quickly, pulling the door shut behind her. She opened the door of the outer office and peeked out. No one there, but the voices from room 6 were louder now, and people were laughing. They were getting ready to break up. It had been an unusually short meeting. Thank God for Mr. Gaunt, she thought, and slipped out into the hall. She had almost reached the front doors when she heard them coming out of room 6 behind her. Sally didn't look around. It occurred to her that she hadn't thought of Mr. Lester Big Prick Pratt for the last 5 minutes, and that was really fine. She thought she might go home and draw herself a nice bubble bath and get into it with her wonderful splinter and spend the next 2 hours not thinking about Mr. Lester Big Prick Pratt and what a lovely change that would be. Yes, indeed. Yes, in... What did you do in there? What was in that envelope? Who put it there, outside the cafeteria? When? And most important of all, Sally, What are you starting?
She stood still for a moment, feeling little beads of sweat form on her forehead and in the hollows of her temples. Her eyes went wide and startled, like the eyes of a frightened doe. Then they narrowed and she began to walk again. She was wearing slacks, and they chafed at her crotch in a strangely pleasant way that made her think of her frequent necking sessions with Lester.
I don't care what I did, she thought. In fact, I hope it's something really mean. He deserves a mean trick, looking like Mr. Weatherby but having all those disgusting magazines. I hope he chokes when he walks into his office.
Yes, I hope he fucking chokes, she whispered. It was the first time in her life she had actually said the F-word out loud, and her nipples tightened and began to tingle again. Sally began to walk faster, thinking in some vague way that there might be something else she could do in the bathtub. It suddenly seemed to her that she had a need or two of her own. She wasn't exactly sure how to satisfy them, but she had an idea she could find out. The Lord, after all, helped those who help themselves.
Does that seem like a fair price? Mr. Gaunt asked Polly.
Polly started to reply, then paused. Mr. Gaunt's attention suddenly seemed to be diverted. He was gazing off into space, and his lips were moving soundlessly, as if in prayer.
Mr. Gaunt?
He started slightly, then his eyes returned to her and he smiled. Pardon me, Polly. My mind wanders sometimes.
The price seems more than fair, Polly told him. It seems divine.
She took her checkbook from her purse and began to write. Every now and then she would wonder vaguely just what she was up to here, and then she would feel Mr. Gaunt's eyes call hers. When she looked up and met them, the questions and doubts subsided again. The check she handed to him was drawn in the amount of $46. Mr. Gaunt folded it neatly and tucked it into the lapel pocket of his sport jacket.
Be sure to fill out the counterfoil, Mr. Gaunt said. Your Snoopy friend will undoubtedly want to see it. He's coming to see you, Polly said, doing exactly as Mr. Gaunt had suggested. He thinks you're a confidence man.
He's got lots of thoughts and lots of plans, Mr. Gaunt said, but his plans are going to change and his thoughts are going to blow away like fog on a windy morning. Take my word for it.
You're not going to hurt him, are you?
Me? You do me a very great wrong, Patricia Chalmers. I am a pacifist, one of the world's great pacifists. I wouldn't raise a hand against our sheriff. I just meant he's got business on the other side of the bridge this afternoon. He doesn't know it yet, but he does.
Oh, now,
Polly?
Yes?
Your check does not constitute complete payment for the Azka.
It doesn't?
No. He was holding a plain white envelope in his hands. Polly didn't have the slightest idea where it had come from, but that seemed perfectly all right. In order to finish paying for your amulet, Polly, you have to help me play a little trick on someone.
Alan?
Suddenly she was as alarmed as a woods rabbit which gets a dry whiff of fire on a hot summer afternoon.
Do you mean Alan?
I most certainly do not, he said. Asking you to play a trick on someone you know, let alone someone you think you love, would be unethical, my dear.
It would?
Yes, although I believe you really ought to think carefully about your relationship with the sheriff, Polly. You may find that it all comes down to a fairly simple choice, a little pain now to save a great deal of pain later. Put another way, those who marry in haste often live to repent in leisure.
I don't understand you.
I know you don't. You'll understand me better, Polly, after you check your mail. You see, I'm not the only one who has attracted his snooping, sniffy nose. For now, let us discuss the small prank I want you to play. The butt of this joke is a fellow whom I have just recently employed. His name is Merrill.
Ace Merrill?
His smile faded. Don't interrupt me, Polly. Don't ever interrupt me when I am speaking. Not unless you want your hands to swell up like inner tubes filled with poison gas. She shrank away from him, her dreamy, dreaming eyes wide.
I'm sorry.
All right. Your apology is accepted. This time. Now listen to me. Listen very carefully.
Frank Jewett and Brian McGinley, the middle school's geography teacher and basketball coach, walked from room 6 into the outer office just behind Alice Tanner. Frank was grinning and telling Brian a joke he'd heard earlier that day from a textbook salesman. It had to do with a doctor who was finding it difficult to diagnose a woman's illness. He had narrowed it down to 2 possibles, AIDS or Alzheimer's, but that was as far as he could go. So the gal's husband takes the doctor aside, Frank went on as they walked into the outer office. Alice was bending over her desk, thumbing through a little pile of messages there, and Frank lowered his voice. Alice could be quite the stick when it came to jokes which were even slightly off color. Yeah? Now Brian was also beginning to grin. Yeah. He's real upset. He says, "Geez, Doc, is that the best you can do? Isn't there some way we can figure out which one she has?" Alice selected 2 of the pink message forms and started into the inner office with them. She got as far as the doorway and then stopped short, as if she'd walked into an invisible stone wall. Neither of the grinning, middle-aged, small-town white guys noticed. "Sure, it's easy," the doc says. "Take her about 25 miles into the woods and leave her there. If she finds her way back, don't fuck her." Brian McGinley gaped foolishly at his boss for a moment, then exploded into hearty guffaws of laughter. Principal Jewett joined him. They were laughing so hard that neither of them heard Alice the first time she called Frank's name. There was no problem the second time. The second time, she nearly shrieked it. Frank hurried over to her. His first thought was vandalism, some stupid piece of juvenile delinquency. "Alice? What?" Then he saw what, and a terrible, glassy fright filled him. His words dried up. He felt the flesh of his testicles crawling madly. His balls seemed to be trying to pull themselves back to where they had come from. It was the magazines, the secret magazines from the bottom drawer. They had been spread all over the office like nightmare confetti. Boys in uniforms, boys in haylofts, boys in straw hats, boys riding hobby horses in ways the manufacturer had never intended. "What in God's name?" The voice, hoarse with horror and fascination, came from Frank's left. He turned his head in that direction, the tendons in his neck creaking like rusty screen door springs, and saw Brian McGinley staring at the wild strew of magazines. His eyes were all but falling out of his face. "A prank," he tried to say. "A stupid prank, that's all. Those magazines are not mine. You only have to look at me to know that magazines like that would hold no interest for a man of my, his what?" He didn't know, and it didn't really matter anyway, because he had lost his ability to speak, entirely lost it. The 3 adults stood in shocked silence, staring into the office of middle school principal Frank Jewett. A magazine which had been precariously balanced on the edge of the visitor's chair riffled its pages in response to a puff of hot air through the half-open window and then fell to the floor. "Saucy young guys," the cover promised. "A prank. Yes, I'll say it was a prank, but will they believe me? Suppose the desk drawer was forced. Will they believe me if it was?" "Mrs. Tanner?" a girl's voice asked from behind them. All 3 of them, Jewett, Tanner, McGinley, whirled around guiltily. 2 girls in red and white cheerleading outfits, 9th graders, stood there. Alice Tanner and Brian McGinley moved almost simultaneously to block the view into Frank's office. Frank Jewett himself seemed rooted to the spot, turned to stone. But they moved just a little too late. The cheerleaders' eyes widened. One of them, Darlene Vickery, clapped her hands to her small rosebud mouth and stared at Frank Jewett unbelievingly. Frank thought, "Oh, good. By noon tomorrow, every student in this school will know. By supper tomorrow night, everyone in town will know." "You girls leave," Mrs. Tanner said. "Someone has played a nasty joke on Mr. Jewett, a very nasty joke, and you are not to say 1 word. Do you understand?" "Yes, Mrs. Tanner," Erin McAvoy said. 3 minutes later, she would be telling her best friend, Donna Boylo, that Mr. Jewett's office had been decorated with pictures of boys wearing heavy metal bracelets and little else. "Yes, Mrs. Tanner," Darlene Vickery said. 5 minutes later, she would be telling her best friend, Natalie Priest. "Go on," Brian McGinley said. He was trying to sound brisk, but his voice was still thick with shock.
Off you go. The two girls fled, cheerleader skirts flipping about their sturdy knees. Brian turned slowly to Frank. I think, he began, but Frank paid no notice. He walked into his office, moving slowly like a man in a dream. He closed the door with the word principal lettered on it in neat black strokes and slowly began picking up the magazines. Why don't you just give them a written confession? Part of his mind screamed. He ignored the voice. A deeper part of him, the primitive voice of survival, was also speaking. And this part told him that right now he was at his most vulnerable. If he talked to Alice or Brian now, if he tried to explain this, he would hang himself as high as Haman. Alice was knocking on the door. Frank ignored her and continued his dream walk around the office, picking up the magazines he had accumulated over the last 9 years, writing away for them one by one, and picking them up at the post office in Gates Falls, sure each time that the state police or a team of postal inspectors would fall on him like a ton of bricks. None ever had. But now, this. They won't believe they belong to you, the primitive voice said. They won't allow themselves to believe it. To do that would upset too many of their comfy small-town conceptions of life. Once you get yourself under control, you'll be able to put it over, but who would have done something like this? Who could have done something like this? It never occurred to Frank to ask himself what mad compulsion had caused him to bring the magazines here, of all places, in the first place. There was only one person Frank Jewett could think of, the one person with whom he'd shared his secret life, George T. Nelson, the high school woodshop teacher. George T. Nelson, who, under his bluff, macho exterior, was just as gay as old Dad's hatband. George T. Nelson, with whom Frank Jewett had once attended a sort of party in Boston, the sort of party where there were a great many middle-aged men and a small group of undressed boys, the sort of party that could land you in jail for the rest of your life, the sort of party... There was a manila envelope sitting on his desk blotter. His name was written on the center of it. Frank Jewett felt a horrible sinking sensation in the pit of his belly. It felt like an elevator out of control. He looked up and saw Alice and Brian peering in at him, almost cheek to cheek. Their eyes were wide, their mouths open, and Frank thought, "Now I know what it feels like to be a fish in an aquarium." He waved at them, "Go away." They didn't go, and this somehow did not surprise him. This was a nightmare. And in nightmares, things never went the way you wanted them to. That was why they were nightmares. He felt a terrible sense of loss and disorientation, but somewhere beneath it, like a living spark beneath a heap of wet kindling, was a little blue flame of anger. He sat behind his desk and put the stack of magazines on the floor. He saw that the drawer they'd been in had been forced, just as he had feared. He ripped open the envelope and spilled out the contents. Most of them were glossy photographs, photographs of him and George T. Nelson at that party in Boston. They were cavorting with a number of nice young fellows, the oldest of the nice young fellows might have been 12, and in each picture George T. Nelson's face was obscured, but Frank Jewett's was crystal clear. This did not much surprise Frank either. There was a note in the envelope. He took it out and read it. "Frank, old buddy. Sorry to do this, but I have to leave town and have no time to fuck around. I want $2,000. Bring it to my house tonight at 7 o'clock p.m. So far, you can wiggle out of this thing. It will be tough, but no real problem for a slippery bastard like you. But ask yourself how you're going to like seeing copies of these pics nailed up on every phone pole in town, right under those casino night posters. They will run you out of town on a rail, old buddy. Remember, $2,000 at my house by 7:15 at the latest, or you will wish you were born without a dick. Your friend, George." Your friend. Your friend. His eyes kept returning to that closing line with a kind of incredulous, wondering horror. Your motherfucking, backstabbing, Judas-kissing friend. Brian McGinley was still hammering on the door. But when Frank Jewett finally looked up from whatever it was on his desk which had taken his attention, Brian's fist paused in mid-stroke. The principal's face was waxy white except for two bright clown spots of flush on his cheeks. His lips were drawn back from his teeth in a narrow smile. He didn't look in the least like Mr. Weatherby. My friend, Frank thought. He crumpled the note with one hand as he shoved the glossy photographs back into the envelope with the other. Now the blue spark of anger had turned orange. The wet kindling was catching fire. I'll be there, all right. I'll be there to discuss this matter with my friend, George T. Nelson. Yes, indeed, Frank Jewett said. Yes, indeed. He began to smile. It was going on 3:15, and Alan had decided Brian Rusk must have taken a different route. The flood of home-going students had almost dried up. Then, just as he was reaching into his pocket for his car keys, he saw a lone figure biking down School Street toward him. The boy was riding slowly, seeming almost to trudge over the handlebars, and his head was bent so low Alan couldn't see his face. But he could see what was in the carrier basket of the boy's bike, a Playmate cooler. "Do you understand?" Gaunt asked Polly, who was now holding the envelope. "Yes, I understand. I do." But her dreaming face was puzzled. "You don't look happy." "Well, I..." "Things like the Ozka don't always work very well for people who aren't happy," Mr. Gaunt said. He pointed at the tiny bulge where the silver ball lay against her skin, and again she seemed to feel something shift strangely inside. At the same moment, horrible cramps of pain invaded her hands, spreading like a network of cruel steel hooks. Polly moaned loudly. Mr. Gaunt crooked the finger he had pointed in a come-along gesture. She felt that shift in the silver ball again, more clearly this time, and the pain was gone. "You don't want to go back to the way things were, do you, Polly?" Mr. Gaunt asked in a silky voice.
"No,"
she cried. Her breast was moving rapidly up and down. Her hands began to make frantic washing gestures, one against the other, and her wide eyes never left his.
"Please, no."
"Because things could go from bad to worse, couldn't they?"
"Yes, yes, they could."
"And nobody understands, do they? Not even the sheriff. He doesn't know what it's like to wake up at 2 a.m. with hell in his hands, does he?" She shook her head and began to weep. "Do as I say, and you'll never have to wake up that way again, Polly. And here is something else. Do as I say, and if anyone in Castle Rock finds out that your child burned to death in a San Francisco tenement, they won't find it out from me." Polly uttered a hoarse, lost cry, the cry of a woman hopelessly ensnarled in a grinding nightmare. Mr. Gaunt smiled. "There are more kinds of hell than one, aren't there, Polly?"
"How do you know about him?" she whispered. "No one knows, not even Alan. I told Alan."
"I know, because knowing is my business. And suspicion is his, Polly. Alan never believed what you told him. He said..." "I'm sure he said all kinds of things, but he never believed you. The woman you hired to babysit was a drug addict, wasn't she? That wasn't your fault. But, of course, the things which led to that situation were all a matter of personal choice, Polly, weren't they? Your choice. The young woman you hired to watch Kelton passed out and dropped a cigarette, or maybe it was a joint, into a wastebasket. Hers was the finger that pulled the trigger, you might say. But the gun was loaded because of your pride, your inability to bend your neck before your parents and the other good people of Castle Rock." Polly was sobbing harder now. "Yet, is a young woman not entitled to her pride?" Mr. Gaunt asked gently. "When everything else is gone, is she not at least entitled to this, the coin without which her purse is entirely empty?" Polly raised her streaming, defiant face.
"I thought it was my business," she said. "I still do. If that's pride, so what?"
"Yes," he said soothingly, spoken like a champion. "But they would have had you back, wouldn't they? Your mother and father? It might not have been pleasant, not with the child always there to remind them, not with the way tongues wag in pleasant little backwaters like this one. But it would have been possible."
"Yes, and I would have spent every day trying to stay out from under my mother's thumb,"
she burst out in a furious, ugly voice which bore almost no resemblance to her normal tone.
"Yes,
Mr. Gaunt said in that same soothing voice. So you stayed where you were. You had Kelton, and you had your pride. And when Kelton was dead, you still had your pride, didn't you? Polly screamed in grief and agony and buried her wet face in her hands. It hurts worse than your hands, doesn't it? Mr. Gaunt asked. Polly nodded her head without taking her face out of her hands. Mr. Gaunt put his own ugly, long-fingered hands behind his head and spoke in the tone of one who gives a eulogy. Humanity! So noble! So willing to sacrifice the other fellow!
Stop! She moaned. Can't you stop?
It's a secret thing, isn't it, Patricia?
Yes.
He touched her forehead. Polly uttered a gagging moan, but did not draw away. That's one door into hell you'd like to keep locked, isn't it? She nodded inside her hands. Then do as I say, Polly, he whispered. He took one of her hands away from her face and began caressing it. Do as I say and keep your mouth shut. He looked closely at her wet cheeks and her streaming reddened eyes. A little moo of disgust puckered his lips for a moment. I don't know which makes me sicker, a crying woman or a laughing man. Wipe your goddamn face, Polly. Slowly, dreamily, she took a lace-edged handkerchief from her purse and began to do it. That's good, he said, and rose. I'll let you go home now, Polly. You have things to do. But I want you to know it has been a great pleasure doing business with you. I have always so enjoyed ladies who take pride in themselves. Hey, Brian, want to see a trick? The boy on the bicycle looked up fast, the hair flying off his forehead, and Alan saw an unmistakable expression on his face, naked, unadulterated fear. Trick? The boy said in a trembling voice. What trick? Alan didn't know what the boy was afraid of, but he understood one thing. His magic, which he had relied upon often as an icebreaker with children, had for some reason been exactly the wrong thing this time. Best to get it out of the way as soon as possible and start over again. He held up his left arm, the one with the watch on it, and smiled into Brian Rusk's pale, watchful, frightened face. You'll notice that there's nothing up my sleeve and that my arm goes all the way up to my shoulder. But now, presto! Alan passed his open right hand slowly down his left arm, snapping the little packet effortlessly out from beneath his watch with his right thumb as he did so. As he closed his fist, he slipped the almost microscopic loop that held the packet closed. He clasped his left hand over his right, and when he spread them apart, a large tissue paper bouquet of unlikely flowers bloomed where there had been nothing but thin air a moment before. Alan had done this trick hundreds of times and never better than on this hot October afternoon, but the expected reaction, a moment of stunned surprise followed by a grin that was one part amazement and two parts admiration, didn't dawn on Brian's face. He gave the bouquet a cursory glance. There seemed to be relief in that brief look, as if he had expected the trick to be of a far less pleasant nature, and then returned his gaze to Alan's face. Pretty neat, huh? Alan asked. He stretched his lips in a big smile that felt every bit as genuine as his grandfather's dentures. Yeah, Brian said. Uh-huh. I can see you're blown away. Alan brought his hands together, deftly collapsing the bouquet again. It was easy. Too easy, really. It was time to buy a new copy of the folding flower trick. They only lasted so long. The tiny spring in this one was getting loose, and the brightly colored paper would soon begin to rip. He opened his hands again, smiling rather more hopefully now. The bouquet was gone, was once more just a small packet of paper under his watchband. Brian Rusk did not return his smile. His face wore no real expression at all. The remnants of his summer tan could not cover the pallor beneath, nor the fact that his complexion was in an unusual state of prepubescent revolt, a scatter of pimples on the forehead, a bigger one by the corner of his mouth, blackheads nesting on either side of his nose. There were purplish shadows under his eyes, as if his last good night's sleep had been a long time ago. This kid is a long way from right, Alan thought. There's something badly sprained, maybe even broken here. There seemed to be two likely possibilities. Either Brian Rusk had seen whoever vandalized the Jurzik house, or he had done it himself. It was pay dirt either way, but if it was the second choice, Alan could barely imagine the size and weight of the guilt which must now be harrowing this boy. "That's a great trick, Sheriff Pangborn," Brian said in a colorless, emotionless voice. "Really. Thanks. Glad you liked it. Do you know what I want to talk to you about, Brian?" "I guess I do," Brian said, and Alan was suddenly sure the boy was going to confess to breaking the windows. Right here on this street corner, he was going to confess, and Alan was going to take a giant step toward unraveling what had happened between Nettie and Wilma. But Brian said nothing more. He only looked up at Alan with his tired, slightly bloodshot eyes. "What happened, son?" Alan asked in that same quiet voice. "What happened while you were at the Jurzik's house?" "Don't know," Brian said. His voice was listless. "But I dreamed about it last night. Sunday night, too. I dream about going to that house. Only in my dream, I see what's really making all the noise." "And what's that, Brian?" "A monster," Brian said. His voice did not change, but a large tear had appeared in each of his eyes, growing on the lower arcs of the lids. "In my dream, I knock on the door instead of riding away like I did, and the door opens, and it's a monster, and it eats me up." The tears brimmed, then rolled slowly down the disturbed skin of Brian Rusk's cheeks. And yes, Alan thought, it could be that, too, simple fright, the sort of fright a little kid might feel when he opens the bedroom door at the wrong time and sees his mother and father screwing. Only, because he's too young to know the look of screwing, he thinks they're fighting. Maybe he even thinks, if they're making a lot of noise, that they're trying to kill each other. But it didn't feel right. It was just that simple. It felt as if this kid were lying his head off, in spite of the haggard look in his eyes, the look that said, "I want to tell you everything." What did that mean? Alan didn't know for sure, but experience taught him that the likeliest solution was that Brian knew whoever had thrown the rocks. Maybe it was someone Brian felt obliged to protect, or maybe the rock thrower knew Brian had seen him, and Brian knew that. Maybe the kid was afraid of reprisals. "A person threw a bunch of rocks into the Jurzik's house," Alan said in a low and, he hoped, soothing voice. "Yes, sir," Brian said, almost sighed. "I guess so. I guess it could have been that. I thought they were fighting, but it could have been someone throwing rocks. Crash, boom, bang." The whole rhythm section was the Purple Gang, Alan thought, but did not say. "You thought they were fighting?" "Yes, sir." "Is that what you really thought?" "Yes, sir." Alan sighed. "Well, you know what it was now, and you know it was a bad thing to do. Throwing rocks through somebody's windows is a pretty serious business, even if nothing else comes of it." "Yes, sir." "But this time, something else did come of it. You know that, don't you, Brian?" "Yes, sir." Those eyes, looking up at him from that calm, pallid face. Alan began to understand two things. This boy did want to tell him what had happened, but he was almost certainly not going to do so. "You look very unhappy, Brian."
"Yes, sir."
"Yes, sir. Does that mean you are unhappy?" Brian nodded, and two more tears spilled from his eyes and rolled down his cheeks. Alan felt two strong, conflicting emotions, deep pity and wild exasperation. "What are you unhappy about, Brian? Tell me."
"I used to have this really nice dream," Brian said in a voice which was almost too low to hear. "It was stupid, but it was nice just the same. It was about Miss Ratcliffe, my speech teacher. Now I know it's stupid. I didn't used to know, and that was better. But guess what? I know more than that now."
Those dark, terribly unhappy eyes rose to meet Alan's again.
The dream I have, the one about the monster who throws the rocks. It scares me, Sheriff Pangborn. But what makes me unhappy are the things I know now. It's like knowing how the magician does his tricks. He nodded his head a little, and Alan could have sworn Brian was looking at the band of his watch. Sometimes it's better to be dumb. I know that now.
Alan put a hand on the boy's shoulder. Brian, let's cut through the bullshit, all right? Tell me what happened. Tell me what you saw and what you did. I came to see if they wanted their driveway shoveled this winter, the boy said in a mechanical, rote voice that frightened Alan badly. The kid looked like almost any American child of 11 or 12, Converse sneakers, jeans, a T-shirt with Bart Simpson on it. But he sounded like a robot which has been badly programmed and is now in danger of overloading. For the first time, Alan wondered if Brian Rusk had maybe seen one of his own parents throwing rocks at the Jerzyk house. I heard noises, the boy was continuing. He spoke in simple declarative sentences, talking as police detectives are trained to talk in court. They were scary noises, bangs and crashes and things breaking. So I rode away as fast as I could. The lady from next door was out on her stoop. She asked me what was going on. I think she was scared, too. Yes, Alan said. Jillian Miss Lebersky. I talked to her. He touched the Playmate cooler, sitting crookedly in the basket of Brian's bike. He was not unaware of the way Brian's lips tightened when he did this. Did you have this cooler with you on Sunday morning, Brian? Yes, sir, Brian said. He wiped his cheeks with the back of his hands and watched Alan's face warily. What was in it? Brian said nothing, but Alan thought his lips were trembling. What was in it, Brian? Brian said a little more nothing. Was it full of rocks? Slowly and deliberately, Brian shook his head. No. For the third time, Alan asked, what was in it?
Same thing that's in it now,
Brian whispered. May I open it and see?
Yes, sir,
Brian said in his listless voice. I guess so. Alan rotated the cover to one side and looked into the cooler. It was full of baseball cards. Tops, Fleer, Donruss. Those are my traders. I carry them with me almost everywhere, Brian said.
You carry them with you?
Yes, sir. Why, Brian? Why do you cart a cooler filled with baseball cards around with you?
I told you, they're traders. You never know when you'll get a chance to make a boss trade with someone. I'm still looking for a Joe Foy. He was on the Impossible Dream Team in 67, and a Mike Greenwell rookie card. The Gator's my favorite player.
And now Alan thought he saw a faint, fugitive gleam of amusement in the boy's eyes. Could almost hear a telepathic voice chanting, "Fooled ya! Fooled ya!" But surely that was only him, only his own frustration mocking the boy's voice. Wasn't it? Well, what did you expect to find inside that cooler anyway? A pile of rocks with notes tied around them? Did you actually think he was on his way to do the same thing to someone else's house? Yes, he admitted. Part of him had thought that, or something like that, was exactly what was going on. Brian Rusk, the pint-sized terror of Castle Rock. The mad rocker. And the worst part was this. He was pretty sure Brian Rusk knew what was going through his head.
Fooled ya. Fooled ya, Sheriff.
Brian, please tell me what's going on around here. If you know, please tell me. Brian closed the lid of the Playmate cooler and said nothing. It made a soft little snick in the drowsy autumn afternoon. Can't say? Brian nodded slowly, meaning, Alan thought, that he was right. He couldn't say. Tell me this, at least. Are you scared? Are you scared, Brian? Brian nodded again, just as slowly. Tell me what you're scared of, son. Maybe I can make it go away. He tapped one finger lightly against the badge he wore on the left side of his uniform shirt. I think that's why they pay me to lug this star around, because sometimes I can make the scary stuff go away. Brian began, and then the police radio Alan had installed beneath the dash of the town and country wagon 3 or 4 years ago squawked to life. Unit one, this is base. Do you copy? Over. Brian's eyes broke away from Alan's. They turned toward the station wagon and the sound of Sheila Brigham's voice, the voice of authority, the voice of the police.
Alan saw that if the boy had been on the verge of telling him something, and it might only be wishful thinking to believe he had been, he wasn't anymore. His face had closed up like a clamshell. You go on home now, Brian. We're going to talk about this dream of yours more later on, okay?
Yes, sir, Brian said. I guess so. In the meantime, think about what I said. Most of what being sheriff's about is making the scary stuff go away.
I have to go home now, Sheriff. If I don't get home pretty soon, my mom's going to be mad at me.
Alan nodded. Well, we don't want that. Go on, Brian.
He watched the boy go. Brian's head was down, and once again, he did not seem to be riding the bike so much as trudging along with it between his legs. Something was wrong there, so wrong that Alan's finding out what had happened to Wilma and Nettie seemed secondary to finding out what had put that tired, haunted expression on the kid's face. The women, after all, were dead and buried. Brian Rusk was still alive. He went to the tired old station wagon he should have traded a year ago, leaned in, grabbed the Radio Shack mic, and depressed the transmit button.
Yeah, Sheila, this is Unit 1. I copy. Come on back.
Henry Payton called for you, Alan, Sheila said. He told me to tell you it's urgent. He wants me to patch you through to him. 10-4?
Go for it, Alan said. He felt his pulse pick up.
It may take a couple of minutes. 10-4?
That's fine. I'll be right here. Unit 1 clear.
He leaned against the side of the car in the dappled shade, mic in hand, waiting to see what was urgent in Henry Payton's life. By the time Polly reached home, it was 20 minutes past 3, and she felt torn in two completely different directions. On one hand, she felt a deep, drumming need to be about the errand Mr. Gaunt had given her. She didn't like to think of it in his terms as a prank. Polly Chalmers was not much of a prankster. To get it done so the Oscar would finally belong to her. The concept that the dealing wasn't done until Mr. Gaunt said the dealing was done had not so much as crossed her mind. On the other hand, she felt a deep, drumming need to get in touch with Alan, to tell him exactly what had happened, or as much of it as she could remember. One thing she could remember, it filled her with shame and a low sort of horror, but she could remember it all right, was this. Mr. Leland Gaunt hated the man Polly loved, and Mr. Gaunt was doing something that was very wrong. Alan should know. Even if the Oscar stopped working, he should know. You don't mean that. But yes, part of her meant exactly that, the part that was terrified of Leland Gaunt, even though she couldn't remember what exactly he had done to induce that feeling of terror. Do you want to go back to the way things were, Polly? Do you want to go back to owning a pair of hands that feel full of shrapnel? No, but neither did she want Alan hurt. Neither did she want Mr. Gaunt to do whatever he was planning to do, if it was something she suspected it was, that would hurt the town. Nor did she want to be a part of that something by going out to the old deserted Camber place at the end of Town Road Number 3 and playing some sort of trick she didn't even understand. So these conflicting wants, each championed by its own hectoring voice, pulled at her as she walked slowly home. If Mr. Gaunt had hypnotized her in some way, she had been positive of this when she left the store, but she became less and less sure as time passed. The effects had worn off now, Polly really believed this, and she had never in her life found herself so incapable of deciding what to do next. It was as if her whole supply of some vital decision-making chemical had been stolen from her brain. In the end, she went home to do what Mr. Gaunt had advised, although she no longer precisely remembered the